Президент Российской Федерации.
На наших глазах творилась история. Президент России, руководитель...
Историческое событие в историческом месте.
Обращение Владимира Путина Федеральному собранию. Президент назвал решение, которое...
Можно смело считать историческим моментом.
В высшей степени исторический. Что примечательно,
реально глава... Искренние эмоции со слезами на глазах.
Рейтинг президента Владимира Путина достиг максимальных показателей за последние...
Russian state television called it a historic and pivotal event. And in many ways it was. Vladimir Putin's speech to a joint session of parliament this week and the ceremony incorporating Crimea into Russia that followed it marked the first time since the end of the Cold War that one country annexed the territory of another. It also marked the first such move in Europe since World War II. And it sent an unambiguous signal to the world that the Kremlin no longer intended to play by the rules that have governed international affairs for more than two decades. But Putin's speech may also turn out to be pivotal and historic in ways the Kremlin leader did not intend. The annexation of Crimea has set off a wave of patriotism and has given a significant boost to Putin's popularity. The opposition appears neutralized, with some even supporting Putin's move. But in resetting Russia's domestic political agenda, the Kremlin leader may have also unleashed forces and set events in motion that he may not be able to control. March 18th, 2014 will certainly go down in Russian history as a pivotal moment. But the question looms, how? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome back, Sean.
Hello.
And joining us from New York City, also via Skype, is Nina Khrushcheva, a professor of international affairs at the New School, whose latest book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, will be out any time now, Nina, if I'm not mistaken. This month, yeah?
It's already, I forgot to take a copy, I would have shown it to you. Yes.
Oh, well, I stand corrected, it's already out. Well, it's good to have you back.
And, thank you.
Nina, let's start with you, because I want to give you a chance to do what you've been doing for the last couple of weeks, and that is defend your family honor. And I know you don't like the words Putin and Khrushchev mentioned even in the same sentence, so I hope you'll forgive me for this clip that has Putin saying Khrushchev. Let's listen.
Инициатором был лично глава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза Хрущев.
The initiator was the head of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, Khrushchev personally. What was his motive? A quest to prop up the Ukrainian leadership of the time? Or a desire to compensate for his involvement in mass repressions in Ukraine in the 1930s? It is for history researchers to determine. What is important is the fact that this decision was taken in an obvious breach of constitutional norms of the time.
Nina, your reaction.
Well, you know, first of all, I mention Putin and Khrushchev in the same sentence all the time because Putin is such a descendant of Soviet leaders in many of his actions, so they really go hand in hand. But I thought it was a brilliant propaganda speech because things were interpreted, misinterpreted, pushed the right buttons. So that I have to give him great credit for this kind of propaganda. Yes, and I'm sure Khrushchev did. I mean, Khrushchev was probably propping the Ukrainian leadership because he was very fond of the country, as you all know. So for him, it was important to give them more power, because one of the policies that were not formally instigated yet, but were already starting to be instigated in 1954 after Stalin's death in 1953 is decentralization. And so that's one of the efforts that he was trying to make. My particular, I just admire Putin so much. I have to say, I can't even for that, because I thought it was such a brilliant line that he's holding Khrushchev responsible for mass repressions. I mean, really, Joseph Stalin is Vladimir Putin's ideological hero, you know, is uniter of lands and creator of a great country. And comparing, I mean, let's talk about those repressions versus kind of going against Khrushchev for repressions. In the 30s, another thing that I find very interesting, because Khrushchev actually came to Ukraine in 1938, after mass repressions, I mean, not that Khrushchev was not involved in any of them or some of them, and certainly was leading some of them in Ukraine, but major of those repressions, especially Holodomor of early 1930s, were already over by the time Khrushchev got in. So I think Vladimir Putin should ask historians to clarify these things for him, because for propaganda, history is really not such an important issue.
Do you think he had some kind of ulterior motive here for taking a pop shot at your great grandfather in this?
I absolutely do, because I don't think, I mean, Khrushchev cannot be possibly his favorite, because I think Putin goes against all these leaders, sort of meek leaders of the past. Not that Khrushchev was particularly meek, but certainly not firm-handed as, once again, Putin's hero Stalin was. So he goes after these people, kind of bumbling leaders of the past that squandered away the Russian greatness, and he, the great Putin, in vain of, I don't know, Peter the Great, Ivan the Terrible, Joseph Stalin, really brings those lands together. So I think it is. It does seem like a small little shot, but Putin is a small little man who does small little shots at people when he feels that he feels is appropriate. So I do think so. Sometimes, I mean, I'm not important in any way, but I do write horrible things about him, kind of much worse than the slouchy man at the back of a classroom, in the words, to repeat the words of Barack Obama. So sometimes it's like, well, is it just basically to tell me that if something that, the whole family is going to be taken out. So, but yes, he is. He wanted to place the blame. I think he wants to devalue the reformist stance even more. And he would take anybody. I mean, the next stop will be Gorbachev and Yeltsin, of course. So I think that is part of a kind of a larger plan to say every reformer in Russia was a wuss, and he, Vladimir Putin, is not.
Yeah, that's what I was suggesting, actually. Yeah, taking a shot at Khrushchev was taking a shot at the reform tradition in Soviet and Russian history. Sean, in an email exchange earlier this week about Putin's speech, you wrote to me that he was becoming the gendarmerie of Eurasia. Would you care to elaborate on that? I thought that was a pretty interesting observation.
Yeah. I've long kind of thought of Putin in the context of the great czars of the imperial period, in particular Nicholas I, and I felt that this speech was really him putting his foot down and acting as the kind of protector against Westernism and revolution in the Eurasian continent. And he said in his speech that with Ukraine, the West has crossed a red line, essentially, and that he essentially wasn't going to take anymore. But I found the speech interesting for a variety of ways, and particularly, first, the nationalism that was in it, this kind of very almost Volkish, romantic nationalism about Crimea always being part of Russia. The fact that Khrushchev gave it over to Ukraine was kind of like severing a limb to some extent. And here Putin is kind of reattaching that limb back to Russia and kind of being the gatherer of Russian peoples. I was actually quite disturbed by the nationalism inherent in the speech. The other thing too is anti-Westernism. I mean, this isn't of course new, and I actually didn't feel that a lot of what Putin was saying in his speech was new. He kind of articulated a lot of these things since he came back to the presidency in 2012, but it was more of a crystallization of some of the views he felt. I mean, he's been speaking against the West and the encroachment of the West. He put it in the framework of Russia being deceived by the West as kind of a victim of Western deception. And the anti-revolution, he's been speaking out against the Arab Spring since its inception and the destabilization that he perceives the West is causing around the world by fomenting and supporting these revolutions. And he felt that Ukraine is just the next step now on his doorstep. And I felt that as kind of he is, you know, putting his foot down to as a bulwark against us through the taking of Crimea.
No, and it certainly was a very effective speech, regardless, as Nina pointed out, regardless of what one thinks of its content or the accuracy of much of its content. But I wanted to cite an interesting piece I read in Nezavisimaya Gazeta this week by Alexei Malashenko. He's the astute observer of Russian domestic politics. And I want to quote from it directly at length because I think it's worth doing so. He writes, quote, tactically, Putin has won. He has for a time bolstered his charisma, having mobilized a nationalist mood and reoriented it against Ukraine and the West. But strategically, Vladimir Vladimirovich has lost. First, he has shown Russia's incapacity for operating with normal economic diplomatic resources. Second, a personal grievance against the Maidan has forced him into actions that surprised everybody, including the sober-minded part of his inner circle. The president has to know that even in the ruling class, many people are perplexed by his Crimean action, and this is contributing to irritation with the leader. Sure, he'll occupy the presidency for a very long time yet to come, but he'll no longer have an ironclad backside. And as an ex-security officer, he surely has to sense this. And keeping nationalist intensity at its height for any length of time is very difficult. People will soon be distracted by things like inflation and other issues from which their attention has been temporarily averted. So he's making two points here, really. He's making one point is that inside the elite, this is causing a bit of nervousness. And with President Obama's announcement of sanctions yesterday, that frankly, that some of the names in that list surprised me. These are truly the people close to Putin, and these are truly things that could hurt Putin's inner circle in the pocketbook, really. We're talking about Timchenko, Kovalchuk, the Bank Russia. We're talking about very, very serious people and entities close to Putin. On the other hand, he's also saying that the public is going to wake up sooner or later. We're going to talk about this later a little bit in the second half of the podcast. But Nina, would you agree with Malashenko? I know you said he's made this point has been made before. You've made this point before. What would you say to what he is?
I mean, this point has been made numerous times before. I think this point was being made as of 2008, the war with Georgia. It has been going on sort of, it was particularly started being made in 2010 and 2011 when it became clear that Putin is coming back to the presidency so he cannot really dupe the world or even his own people saying, well, I'm kind of a democratic leader in this sense. So this is a crystallized point, but it's not entirely an original point that strategically, I mean, Putin is a brilliant tactician. There's no question about it. He sees an opportunity. He's a I think on this podcast, we've been talking about it. He's a politician of opportunity. He sees an opening and he goes in it. And strategically for that great Russia that Sean was so eloquently talking about, it is very true. I mean, it does work because that is a great strategy to be that great Russia. How it plays out, I mean, we are not in Nicholas I environment anymore. And so how does it play out in the 21st century? That is a very important strategic question. And I do think that his people have been shivering for at least a number of years because he has not had that backside. And I think one of the reasons I think the Sochi was such a big story is because you really cannot collapse. I mean, you know, Russians are patriotic. You cannot collapse your government or your Kremlin while they're preparing to show the world right in Sochi. But I think it's just going a little downhill from there because the Sochi is over. That great patriotism is going to die down. The belts are going to be tightened because this sanctions actually, the further they go and the broader they go, the more people will be affected. And I know people say, well, Russians are slaves and they're going to tolerate that. I'm not sure. I really think that people really would like their vacations in the Alps and Antalya very much so. And for that emotional idea of a great state that was fine in Joseph Stalin's times, but really not fine in Vladimir Putin's times. So I think the miscalculation is tremendous. I don't think he sees the world the way the world is.
Yeah. And I think you're right that I don't think the Russian people are going to like what this is going to mean for them, because you have now for more than a decade, people have been accustomed to being integrated with the world economy and reaping all the benefits that are associated associated with this. And this great Russia kind of cuts against that. And it's, you can't have both, I don't think. Sean, what's your reaction to this point?
Well, Malashenko is basing the assumption on that the elite around Putin has power to sway decision making, and they could put pressure on him. And this is the strategy of the sanctions, right? If you put these people who are close to Putin under a sanctions regime, this is going to put pressure because they're going to lose a lot of money. They're going to be cut out from financial markets. I mean, I just read earlier that Visa and MasterCard canceled their deals with the Bank of Russia. So this is going to affect the pocketbook. But what's interesting about it, I think this actually ironically might play in Putin's favor in consolidating his own power. I mean, as you pointed out, I think last week, the New York Times did this wonderful article about Putin's circle is quite shrunken, mm-hmm. that he's really only the people around him are mostly security people. He's only advising them. The decision to go into Crimea seems to be only taken at their advice, not kind of advising in the broader circle of elites around him. And I assume that these people have completely shorn off their foreign assets. They're within Russia itself. And Putin, you know, remember, has been trying to renationalize the elite for over a year. And I think this, and some people have indicated this, and you see this in the Russian conservative press right now, a lot of people are talking about this is finally the opportunity for Putin to really renationalize the elite, because he could play the patriotism card. He can say, well, you have your assets abroad. I've been telling you for a year you're going to be vulnerable. And now sanctions have come down on you. Well, repatriate your money and everything will be okay. So I think this – and the elite, I think, has been – over the last – since Putin came back to the presidency, he's completely purged out the more technocratic liberal elite from his advice circle. And you could see from the sheer non-reaction of Russian elites, you've been hearing things about people being nervous, but nobody is stepping up and speaking out against anything. So I think this might actually, at least in the short term, consolidate his rule and increase his power within his own inner circles.
But the thing that makes me think this might be a little bit more serious is this isn't just about people with their apartments in Florida or their townhouses in London. We're talking about Gennady Timchenko. We're talking about Arkady Rotenberg. We're talking about Kovalchuk. These are the bankers of Russia Incorporated. These are the bank. This is how Putin's inner circle itself moves its money. Timchenko can't repatriate his asset. He's a Finnish citizen. Right? Mm-hmm. If he's going to repatriate it, he has to repatriate it to Finland. He also lives in Switzerland, and this is going to affect Russia's ability to reap to continue to reap the benefits of integration into the global economy. Mm-hmm. It's going to hit them in their pocketbook. Yeah, repatriate what you have, but this is going to stop their ability to operate, no?
Yeah, but it certainly will. But as you pointed out also last week, there's a conservative ideology that's gaining more traction. And the question is how much has Putin's circle has grafted onto this ideology mm-hmm. of decoupling from the West and reorientate the country towards the East. Now, if this ideology is indeed having a lot of currency in Putin's circle, then it sounds like they're going to be, if they're driven by this ideology, they're willing to take the risk to decouple from the West or at least turn more to the East. So I don't know how this will exactly play out, but I think you see this in the conservative press, this ideology being articulated, the elites being referred to as fifth columnists within the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do have to wonder, though, with whether they've thought through the next several steps that are going to take place here and the consequences. Nina, do you get the sense that they have?
I think Sean is absolutely right that it will cement them for the time being, precisely because that kind of Russian victimhood really has been going on for a thousand years. We are the victim of the West. The West is always out to get us. So that, I'm sure, will work to some degree. But it is true that, you know, once again, Russia is not the 19th century. It's not even the Soviet Union of the 20th century. I don't know how is it possible now to build Putinism in one separately taken country, to paraphrase or to translate Stalin's words. And that's exactly what he's doing. В одной отдельно взятой стране. How could you do this? It is very difficult, because even if he moves himself, sort of separates himself from the West, moves to the East, fine. China doesn't want to be out of international institutions.
No way.
Wants to rule the world. So that's your partner that is really not going to be working out in the long run for you. Then there is Iran. I mean, we talk about the new Cold War and those divisions. Then we talk about Iran, and I think that whole gay propaganda law, the family values, all these other values could create some sort of an agreement. But I also think that Putin is such a vain man. He really wants to be, he wants the onlookers. He doesn't want to be Kim Jong-un of North Korea. Right. He really wants to have the world look at him, tremble, but he wants to sit at that same very table. And I think that is, sort of the way Sean phrased it was very, very good, is exactly how the elites are going to be repatriated. But I don't know if they can. I mean, that's the thing. You don't understand that. Actually, I'm so glad my book is coming out right now. The Gulag of the Russian Mind. Hello.
No, what it is. Well, we got to do a podcast about your book, and I apologize for not knowing it's already out. I thought it was coming out momentarily.
But what I mean is that Gulag of the Russian Mind is that how that Gulag can really last without barbed wire. It can last for some while. I don't know if it can last for long.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually, before I came into the studio, I was pondering a blog post called "A Cold War with Hot Money," because that's basically what we're gonna have right now. I was recalling Garry Kasparov was in Prague back in 2007 for some conference here, and a journalist asked him, and at the time tensions between Russia and the West were rising, and they asked if Kasparov thought this could degenerate into another Cold War, and he looked derisively and said, "Какая холодная война, все их деньги в западной банке." So what kind of Cold War could we have when all their money is in the Western banks? Well, we may be about to find out. Now, along these same lines of Malashenko, political analyst Nikolai Petrov had the following chilling prognosis about how this is all going to turn out. Let me quote from this. This is in an interview with Nizhovisa Magazeta. He said, quote, there will be a surge in Putin's popularity and a consolidation of the legitimacy of the regime. But this surge will be very brief. When the price is clarified, we will see that people are not prepared to pay it. Not prepared to take part in a war, not prepared to live under stiff sanctions of the West and so forth. And Putin's task will be, in this short time, to organize repressive mechanisms in order, when the public enthusiasm subsides, to preserve the system and control the country. Yesterday, we saw Dosh TV lost its lease in the Krasnaya Chabar building on the Moscow River where it had been broadcasting from. Yeah, Sean, Petrov makes two points here. First, he says eventually the cost of this adventure will lead to a more assertive dissent in opposition. But then once this happens, Team Putin's going to have to crack the whip even more. Would you agree? Does this scenario look plausible?
I think his speech already alluded to that. I mean, he spoke about fifth columnists and the need to deal with them appropriately. And I think since the Ukraine erupted, we've been seeing a kind of concerted kind of crackdown, at least on media, and certainly the house arrest of Alexei Navalny, the closing down of his blog, and the closing down of other, I mean, relatively small, I'd have to say, media outlets, except for Lenta. And Doge, which are big deal. But the other ones are relatively small. But nonetheless, you are seeing.
Kontaktia.
Yeah, that's a big one as well too. That is a big one as well. So we are seeing a certain tightening of the screws on all of this, and if you couple this with the level of high propaganda, which we'll talk about, there is a consolidation of at least control over the narrative in society as best that they can. So I completely think, you know, if you remember what Putin's government did after the Orange Revolution 2004-2005, they did a similar reconsolidation then, and I expect them to do a reconsolidation now. Now, the only thing I do have to question is are these sanctions actually going to affect regular people? Because we haven't gotten there yet.
No.
And Obama has said that the only future sanctions will depend on any future military moves on the part of the Kremlin. So they could just stick with, as of now, we only know they're going to hit a certain individual elite, so we don't know if they'll ever really affect regular people as a whole, except for those people who are trying to withdraw money off the Bank of Russia right now. But But this is a question: if sanctions do extend even further, how much this will hit the regular
population? Well, the finance ministry has already said that these sanctions could affect Russia's borrowing costs. It was downgraded by a lot of the rating agencies already, so it's their bonds were downgraded already. And along the lines of the repression, there was a very interesting tweet by Alexei Navalny after President Obama's announcement of the sanctions and the release of the list of the names on the sanctions. There was a lot of overlap between the names on that list and the names that Navalny wrote in a New York Times op-ed yesterday. That he said who the people you really need to sanction, and he tweeted, "Well, I guess I better pack my bags for the CISO." You know that he's going to be placed in, not just in house arrest, but placed in actual confinement is what he thinks, which probably makes sense. If I were Mr. Navalny right now, I would be pretty nervous about my freedom. No.
Yeah, and I would actually think that you're going to see a concerted campaign to paint him as a CIA asset. I saw on Kommersant FM there was a talk about him basically playing this international game and it potentially destroying his political career because he's going to be seen as a Western agent that he's already seen by, as in some circles. But I would certainly be concerned if I was him.
Yeah, no, and as Kevin Rothrock pointed out in Global Voices, there's a split developing among nationalists over this whole enterprise, and Navalny is unambiguously on the side of the nationalists the smaller side on the nationalists that is against this move. Nina, what do you think? Big wave of repression coming? Bigger wave of repression coming?
Well, repressions are expensive. I mean, that's another thing. I mean, I agree. I absolutely agree with Petrov that this is a scenario that can develop precisely because this is all emotional patriotism on Sochi, on Crimea, but it's really, the greatest thing about propaganda, I mean, why democratic propaganda is somewhat more successful than totalitarian one is precisely because it actually has roots in reality. Once you have no roots in reality, then there is a problem. Then you just march in orders and then hate everybody in the kitchen. So, and I really think that would be approaching, but gulags are expensive.
Mm.
And building them in 5 seconds or less is really, I mean, Putin should have, if he was going to go that route, he should have thought it through better when he was very popular. By 2004, they should have been, that system should have already been created. But it wasn't. So we'll see what happens. Yes, they should be, we all should be worried. And I think actually, frankly, I know I've been hit for that and, I take responsibility, but I think the sanctions should go, every nation deserves its government. So, if we're going to tolerate that yet again, I mean, come on, how many cycles? I mean, Sean knows it better than anybody. How many cycles through the same pendulum swings we go back and forth? We need to take responsibility. Sanction us all. I'm ready to go to Moscow. Ban my visa. Ban my everything. I mean, I'm poor, so that doesn't matter to me. Ban my everything. I really need to be responsible for the government. If I love him 70%, fine. I have to be responsible for that. And I think that's how Russia should be treated now, because all this, kind of meek measures would not work, should not work. And finally, Russia really should make this decision.
Yeah, I'm really curious right now to see how the elite is truly reacting to this round of sanctions. And I don't know about the two of you, but when I saw these names on the list, I was a little surprised. I didn't expect to see people like this on the list just yet. This is, I mean, Obama kind of, he didn't drop the big one yesterday, but he dropped a big one. And I'm wondering if the Europeans, I'm sure he coordinated with Europe on this. I mean, for God's sake, Timoshenko is an EU citizen.
I have a question. Yeah. May I ask a question to both of you? So today Putin announced that he's going to hold off Russian sanctions. Do you think he's backing off? Do you think it's just a kind of tactical play of some sort?
That is a very good question, because I was wondering, we were having that exact same discussion in the newsroom. The editors here at RFE were like, oh, maybe they did really get to him. I'm not sure.
We know that, but I wonder what's the play here.
There's not really much they can do along these lines, because it's not like Western officials are laundering their money in Russia, right? Or at least not that I know about. Sean, what was your take on that?
Yeah, I don't know if, I mean, the thing is what kind of sanctions that will be in place that will actually do anything. I don't see them. The Russian sanctions are basically just to do sanctions because sanctions were placed on them. They're completely ineffective. Putting visa bans, as they did yesterday on John Bonner and John McCain, I mean, they're just silly. So maybe they're holding off to kind of rethink or maybe come up with something a little bit more effective.
Yeah, no, I
don't know.
Like the adoption, sort of this something that really
right.
Yeah, something that really hit Russian children actually more than anybody. Yes. McCain's comment along those lines was, I guess my spring break in Siberia is off. All right, well, Nina, you mentioned propaganda, which at the time was a good segue, and I'm going to kind of reach back and take that segue and say in a few moments we'll continue our discussion of the fallout from Russia's annexation of Crimea and take a closer look at the Kremlin's propaganda campaign. It seems to have convinced the Russian public in the short run, but will it last? I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. And joining us from New York City, also via Skype, is Nina Khrushcheva, a professor of international affairs at the New School, whose latest book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, will be out this week. I'd also like to remind you that you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Main perpetrators of the coup were nationalists, neo-Nazis, Russophobes, and anti-Semites. These are exactly the people who are still up to this day in control of life in Ukraine.
That, of course, was a clip from Vladimir Putin's speech. Does propaganda work? Westerners have long looked on with derision at the over-the-top and clearly inaccurate way the Russian state-controlled media have depicted events in Ukraine. A coup by neo-Nazis that has unleashed a wave of anti-Semitism and reprisals against Russian speakers, sparking a humanitarian crisis and a surge of refugees escaping the chaos. Who would believe this stuff, right? I mean, the facts on the ground so obviously run counter to the distorted, outright false picture the Kremlin spin masters have so carefully painted. Well, apparently somebody does believe it. According to Lev Gudkov, director of the independent Levada Center, one of Russia's most respected pollster, between November, when mass protests and demonstrations started in Kiev, until late February, when President Viktor Yanukovych was deposed, a clear majority of Russians thought what was happening in Ukraine was an internal matter and that Russia should not intervene. They also saw the Euromaidan uprising as a battle against a corrupt regime. In a recent interview with Gazeta.ru, Gudkov said that, quote, the propaganda campaign that began in the last week of February, which was unusual in its intensity and aggressive tone, has drastically changed the public mood. Now, according to Gudkov, nearly 60% favor the deployment of troops to Crimea, and nearly 80% consider it to be part of Russia. Quote, the propaganda has stunned people. The public is now in an agitated state with all of their imperial complexes awakened, Gudkov said. But Gudkov added that this will not last. After a while, the effect will wear off and a pensive state will set in. Nina, your thoughts?
I completely agree. I think that, on Sochi, I really think that Crimea is not possible without Sochi. I think it is a very important, there is a very important connection, because, Putin really felt that he did something that everybody said nobody, that he couldn't do, and he did it. He got most medals, and he now felt that, he has the right to show, not just to display, not just the soft power, supposedly, that Russia has, but also the hard power. So it did work for a while because, you know, that's how propaganda works. You hit all the right buttons. You talk about the West is out to get us, which is a very, very important important point for the Russians to hear. Then the West doesn't believe us that we can do all these great things, and we can. The West is interfering in our affairs and whatnot. So even reasonable people start thinking, well, if I hear it all the time, or if the state tells me and I see that it is true, then, of course, that must be true. I see it, a bit of it is true. that must be true. I was in Russia today. I have to say I was brave to go to be interviewed by Russia Today. And it was really quite remarkable because the lady who interviewed me, she was just so proud of her American training because I said, oh, my God, you're such a good propagandist. Where did you get this? It's like I was trained in America, implying that, in fact, she got all the skills in the United States because the United States is just double-faced, horrible, horrible place. And said, no, there is actually a difference between slanting the news and distorting the news. But I don't think that Russians quite understand yet that there is this difference. And what they're getting is an absolute distortion that now on the emotional wave they're willing to accept. But I absolutely agree that reality will set in a couple of months. And something that we discussed in earlier parts of this podcast is that suddenly all the, you know, the pocket, their pockets will be hit, their travel schedules will be hit. Russia already, I mean, yes, it was all great when Russia was growing, GDP was growing 8% in the 2000s. Now it went down to 1%, maybe 2%. And that is really going to be the reality. So the great Russia with absolutely no clothes on, no food on your table and clothes on your back is not going to work out in the 21st century. I come back to this.
Sean?
Yeah, I think I would also agree with a lot of that. And I would also point out that, you know, the propaganda that's coming out about Ukraine, it's also within a larger context of the general propaganda that's painting a very Russian narrative of world events, right? Russians have been exposed to a narrative about the Arab Spring, about revolution causing chaos, about the Western's encroachment, about, you know, we're under siege from the West. And there, Ukraine, the propaganda of Ukraine just further flows into that. So I think that they're not only just crafting a narrative about the events in Ukraine, but they're further crafting a worldview. Now, will this all kind of collapse after a while? My fear that what will it actually do is actually just set in a hard cynicism where people will get tired of seeing all of this on the television. They'll retreat into other things, into entertainment, their own personal lives. They'll get tired of hearing all this. And rather than being kind of upset that they've been given, you know, essentially lies in a lot of cases, that they just become more cynical about politics in general, about the information that they're getting, which I think ultimately benefits Putin in the end.
Because they'll become passive. And
yeah.
Nina?
Actually, I totally agree with Sean. I mean, it was very well put, except for the last point that it benefits Putin, because I think it does benefit Putin to a degree, but also what you're describing, Sean, very correctly, it's a Brezhnev state, and we know what happened to the Brezhnev state. And Crimea may be, you know, I mean, I know these comparisons may not be, I mean, they're not clearly entirely direct, but, you know, what if Crimea is Putin's Afghanistan? Because it's entirely possible. It's the same on sort of on the border of he's protecting. Well, then they were protecting world communism. Now they're protecting the Russianism, which basically now he sees as the same thing. So you're right completely, but also history tells us that there are great disadvantages for this kind of environment for those in the Kremlin.
It's interesting you should say Afghanistan, Nina, because the Alexei Malashenko article I quoted in the first half of the podcast, he made this point in the article that he said that this whole situation is going to turn into a domestic Afghanistan for Putin, is what he what he predicted.
Yes, exactly.
Sean, do you looking back into Russian history, do you see any parallels with other periods where patriotic like fever was ratcheted up like this?
Yeah. I mean, the most obvious one that people have pointed out is August 1914, where you get a wave of Russian patriotism, you get a lot of germophobia and even attacks on German Russian citizens. I mean, subjects of the Tsar. So this is the one parallel that I've heard that I think is probably the closest one. And of course, we all know how that turned out
exactly.
In the end. But we shouldn't equate Crimea to World War I in the level of conflict. And I would be hesitant to actually compare it to kind of an Afghan war, because you know we don't have a war going on. We have an occupation of Crimea and we have an annexation of Crimea, but we don't yet have a war with Ukraine. And I do think that if Russia does incur or at least tries to annex eastern parts of Ukraine, we could definitely get that scenario, which I hope nobody wants.
No.
But I think that could definitely backfire for Putin in many ways.
I wanted to quote again from the Gudkov interview in Gazette Rus, which, by the way, is highly recommended reading. I linked to it on a blog post I put up last night. But here he's talking about the very nature of propaganda in itself. And this kind of goes beyond the when the sanctions bite, when people see what this all means, they'll stop believing the propaganda. This is the kind of it's about the reverse effect that the propaganda could actually have. I think this is a really, really succinct way of putting it. Let me quote from Gudkov now. He wrote, quote, propaganda's effectiveness is directly linked to the subject. It's very difficult to convince people that the authorities consist of competent and decent people. But it's easy to convince them that Americans torture adopted Russian children because this cannot be verified. Basically, propaganda destroys alternative understandings. It may not quite convince people, but it imposes on them the cynical view that everybody is a bastard, that politics is a squabble between interest groups, and nobody should be believed. The Kremlin spin doctors and manipulators do not understand that after a while this will turn against the Russian authorities themselves, because imposing such a view on social processes in a country dominated by a paternalistic and statist mindset cannot but lead to increasingly negative attitudes towards the authorities themselves. This should end with clear analogies or the association of the current Russian authorities with the Yanukovych regime. I thought that was just a very wise words, first of all, but a very interesting kind of dissection of propaganda in general and this propaganda in particular. It's a double-edged sword, Sean. No, is he right?
I mean, it can be, because the problem with Russian propaganda is it's too forceful. And in the sense of the most successful propaganda, and here you could look at, say, Fox News, which I do think is a very, very successful form of propaganda, where it positions itself as revealing truths that others won't reveal. Mm-hmm. And it positions itself as an outsider. And here, what really plays well to a propaganda machine like that is that you have alternatives that present a certain worldview, and you claim to be presenting a worldview that nobody else is doing. This is what Russia Today tries to do as well. Mm-hmm. And regardless of what we think of Russia Today, it's fairly successful.
Yeah, it is.
And in terms of capturing an audience. What Russian propaganda is, it's too crude. It's too forceful, and it's too all-encompassing. I mean, if they wanted to be really smart about it, they would actually promote Doge TV rather than trying to clamp down on it, because they could say, well, we're presenting a different point of view that, you know, you're not going to get anywhere else.
This was the Surkov strategy in the old Kremlin.
Exactly. But this being too crude, I mean, you could turn, as I already said, you could turn people into, you know, exactly what Gudkov says, that everybody else is a bastard. So there's nothing – why believe anything? There's nothing to believe in.
Because it creates cynicism about everything.
Mm-hmm.
Nina, would you agree?
Well, same. I mean, I think I already said that the problem with totalitarian propaganda, that it basically doesn't allow you once it doesn't allow you to speak back, you start speaking in the kitchen, and that creates cynicism, but also it creates dissidentship. It creates, because when you have an opening, when you kind of have this pot a bit open, then the conversation seems to be going, say, you have Echo Moskvy, you have Russia Today, but, you know, there's supposedly some sort of a conversation going on. Where there is no conversation going on, Lenta.ru is closed and everything is closed, you create kitchen dissidents. And we know what happens then with this. So I completely agree with Gudkov. I mean, actually, there is a fantastic book that was widely read in 2000 in the United States, French philosopher Jacques Allou, who has a book called Propaganda, and he really explains all the types and why democratic propaganda is better than totalitarian, precisely because after a while, cynical society, the despot suffers more from his own message than even his people.
Sean, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that the one danger that I can think of off the top of my head that could be against Putin is Putin Putin's regime is about a kind of organic, creating an organic society where everyone is kind of harmoniously living together. What this propaganda does is it splits people between those who have access to other information, say on the internet, say a Doge TV if it ends up existing. But enough Russians have other places to go to find out information through social media, through websites, through even the print media in Russia, which I think is actually very, very good for the most part. And then you have another section of society that's completely dependent upon for their information. They're dependent upon television, and this could split society into two different opposing viewpoints of society. And I think that this could eventually kind of break the kind of organic whole that Putinism tries to put forward.
Yeah, and Kirill Coburn's made the point numerous times in this podcast that Russia is already divided between the internet people and the TV people.
Right.
Something I noted is that the last time Putin's popularity was higher, it reached the peak of his popularity, was around the time of the Georgia War. He had already left the presidency, of course. Medvedev was president, but nobody doubted who was in charge. But then 3 years after that, after the patriotic fervor that came out of that faded, and we had 2011. We had basically the regime in its most defensive crouch that we've ever seen it. And you have to wonder, I mean, is it going to be 3 years again, or how soon is it going to take for this to wear off? One last thing I wanted to touch on before we wrap up is the continuous and ubiquitous use of World War II imagery. I mean, really, I mean, the only place I can see more Nazis than on Russian television is the History Channel. I mean, this is, and all this comes as Russia approaches the 70th anniversary of Victory Day next year. And I'm citing liberally from Gudkov because I just think it was just a fascinating interview. Here's what Gudkov has to say about that. He argues that this means that Russia is no longer a hybrid regime. It's basically formally becoming an authoritarian regime. Citing the Yale University political scientist Juan Linz, Gudkov said, quote, "An authoritarian regime, unlike a totalitarian one, does not require ideologies. It does not have constructions for the future and the objectives of building a new unheard of society, the thousand-year Reich, communism, or something like that. Under authoritarian rule, the government idealizes the past, an artificial past, an invented past, as a means of ensuring that the population is passive. If there is no future, no idea of the future, then there does not need to be the objective of breaking and rebuilding anything. What is needed is the reproduction of things that already exist. All that needs to be done is the removal of provocateurs and the sterilization of the discontented ones. The authority's activity is reduced to a purely protective policy." Sean, your thoughts on that?
I think this is a really insightful comment. Because this is one of the things that Kirill has said repeatedly about Putin's system, is that it doesn't offer a future for Russia. It doesn't put forward even an ideology that says this is what we're working to. This is the future of the Russian dream. This is the type of society we want. It's completely conservative in the sense that it looks to the past. And World War II is one of the main narratives that Putin is using to kind of craft this idealized past. And I actually think that I'm surprised that more people haven't paid attention to the ubiquity of World War II rhetoric. And it's everywhere, it seems. And it's really – it's been positioned under Putin as the most sacred holiday, May 9th. It's the most sacred historical event, and they're tapping into it constantly. And I right now can't say what this all means in terms of how – it's being used as a present and even kind of a future form of ideology. But I think it is a really insightful passage that it does create a kind of a system that doesn't look to build anything, but really consolidate and even kind of purge the infections within its society that rattle that narrative rather than building for something in the future.
Nina, do you think they can keep going to this well? Because they've been going to—they're going to with a lot of intensity now, but they've been going to this well for a long time.
No, they have been, and actually, I think people did pay attention because Putin came in with that idea that Stalin is our все, even if he didn't say that. But a lot of people said it instead of him, precisely because they needed a consolidated narrative after the disarray of the Yeltsin years. And that has been, I mean, you know, you go to Moscow, you go to Kursk, you see that there is a Soviet anthem of 1944 right there engraved in gold with Stalin's name. So there's certainly, they've been going at it for a long, long time. But I think what's a really important part, and with Kirill and Gudkov and everybody, I think, on this podcast, we've been saying it all along, that Russia has no future. It barely has the present, and it only has the past. And it's exactly what they're recycling. And so that brings me back again to our strategic conversation or strategy conversation. At the beginning is that when you have this old recycled paradigm of greatness, and we know that this paradigm's collapsed bitterly, what kind of expectations you have for the future? So hence, there is no strategy. And I think that it probably going to unravel rather fast, and rather faster than longer, I think.
Sean, last word to you before we wrap it up.
Yeah, I wonder how long they can play on this World War II narrative, in pure generational terms. I mean, you're having the generation that lived through the war and grew up in the ashes of the war is getting older and dying out. I think Putin's generation is really the last generation that has any kind of personal ties to at least the aftermath of the war. And I wonder how this ideology or these narratives are really playing up on the younger generation and how much they could really tap into it. I think after the 70th anniversary, it's going to get hard because you're just not going to have the physical presence of people who experienced that war experience to be able to transmit it to the rest of the citizenry.
Yeah, I mean, you have to give it, especially that the generation that's coming up now, they don't even remember the Soviet Union, let alone the war.
Right.
I guess I stand corrected. Last word to you.
Can I just one last moment? And I think it goes back to what you said about the drumbeat of the war in 2008, Putin's popularity. Now that sort of possible war, the Ukraine, the drumbeat, the World War II, is every propagandist would tell you war is a breeding ground of propaganda. When propagandists start evoking war, that means that they're in really big, big trouble. And, you know, I just want to come back to this. I think this regime is in great trouble.
And we've been thinking this for a while, and they continue to survive. But you just have to wonder if they didn't overplay their hand to a perhaps tragic degree this time. We'll see in the weeks and months and possibly years to come. And that's all, unfortunately, we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. And joining us from New York City, also via Skype, has been Nina Khrushcheva, a professor of international affairs at the New School, whose latest book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, was released this month. Thanks to both of you for an interesting discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I would like to thank our superhuman producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.